One, two, three, car!
We're counting down, we're counting up again. We're ranking all the Beatles songs. We're counting down, we're counting up again. We're ranking all the Beatles songs. Ranking them songs away. Counting them songs away.
You rank some Poppy songs? You rank some Druggy songs?
You rank some George songs? You rank some Ringo songs?
Ooh,
there you go.
Ooh, look at that.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to Ranking the Beatles, episode number 43. How's everybody doing this week? Hope you're all doing smashingly. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Julia.
Welcome to our show. How's it going this week? How are you, my dear?
I'm good. I'm really tired.
Yeah, we've had a busy one.
We have had a busy one, and it feels good. Like, lots of people are getting vaccinated.
Yeah.
Where things in New Orleans, where we are, feel like they're kind of opening up a little bit. We're easing ourselves back into some life.
Yeah.
We went to some breweries this weekend.
We did. I had three shows this weekend. I played three shows, socially distant shows this weekend. I haven't sang that much in a long time. So for those of you who have commented in the past on my sultry voice, today I've got that real deep thing going.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Very Barry White.
I feel like I'm even a little raspy today.
Yeah.
Because when you go to a show and you're wearing a mask and you're trying to talk over the music and through a mask, you have to talk pretty loudly.
Yep.
So there was a lot of that this weekend. It was nice to, like, see some friends out. Yeah. And have a little fun outside of the house.
Yeah. I did two shows this weekend. It's Easter weekend on the calendar as we're recording in real time today. I had two shows this weekend with my Beatles cover band, The Walrus. And lots of fun to get out and play those songs with those guys. And the crowds all seem to really enjoy it, as they generally tend to do. Because the songs are, you know, pretty good. So. we actually added this week's song into the set list for the first time.
Yeah.
And it was good. Didn't even rehearse it. We just all talked about it over text and gave it a listen and showed up and did the dang thing. And
well, I mean, everyone in your band are amazing musicians in their own right. Like,
thank you.
You're all very talented people who know and love the Beatles. So I feel like for a not super complicated song,
sure,
that's like, it's not surprising for me because you're all very talented and like you sort of know these songs. And if there's like a little part to it that you don't know, like you can, there's the internet. So you just look it up really quick. But like, yeah, you guys are, you're total pros.
Oh man. Thank you.
You're amazing. Everyone's always impressed.
Making me feel real good today.
Aww.
We actually, on Thursday night, Thursdays was like a pop-up last minute show. And we took about 10 minutes during soundcheck and learned Getting Better and This Boy.
Goodness.
Which was like, even I was impressed by how quickly we did that.
Yeah.
So always fun to play those songs. Always fun to immerse myself in this Beatle life I've found myself in. Which, speaking of immersing ourselves in Beatle life, let's talk about our guest this week. So, y'all, if Beatles fandom has one thing that there's certainly no shortage of, it is books about the Beatles. It's really its own, like, separate industry. I currently have 30 in our house, which I'm sure to Julia or the average person probably seems like overkill.
Well, we have in our house, we have some shelves in the living room, sort of around the TV, bookshelves, obviously. And then I had some shelves built upstairs in this little hallway area for his record collection. And I told him, I was like, you have to take all your Beatles books and split them up between the living room shelves and the upstairs shelves. Because if anyone looks at all of your books together, they're going to leave immediately. They're going to be like, this is too much.
Or they're going to be like, do you host a podcast about the Beatles? yeah. So, you know, we have like 30 in our house. And I'm realizing now after looking through our guest Instagram feed that I'm missing a ton of books. And that's a big bummer. But that's, you know, the 30 that I do have, though, that is like a drop in the pond. Thousands of books have been written about the Beatles. Lord knows how many magazines have been devoted to them. Our guest today hosts a podcast in which he chats with the authors of various books about the Beatles, as well as his own collection. It's quite extensive and fantastic. The podcast is fantastic with some amazing stories and discussions. Super excited to have him on as we continue to make all kinds of new friends in Beatle podcast land. So everybody, please welcome to the show the host of the Beatles Books podcast, Joe Wisby. Well, let's hop into it a little bit. I want to ask you, as we always kind of do, how do you first discover the Beatles? What was your first entry into this world?
Well, bizarrely, I can remember I can't remember, but I can tell you the date that I first kind of discovered the Beatles because, and I have told this story on other podcasts, but I will share it again with you because I love telling it. So in 1992, I was 8 years of age and I was a big soccer fan, football fan. and that day there was a big football match that was the England were playing. It was a Sunday afternoon. And before the match started, ITV, the channel that was showing the match, was showing Help. Mm-hmm. And I was unaware, obviously, of really who or what the Beatles were. So the TV was on Sunday afternoon in the living room, and I just caught sight of the beginning of Help, where, as you probably both know, they get out of their car and they go into what looks like four separate houses, mm-hmm. and then they behind the door, it's one big house.
I love that.
I was like, that looks cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, my eight-year-old head was like, that looks like the most fun ever. So I watched them, and of course, Help's this crazy roly-poly, big bright colours, them having a great time. I was like, this is great, and I love the songs. Now, that weekend in June of 92 was Paul McCartney's 50th birthday. Mm-hmm. So they were showing, that was why they were showing Help. And then later on in the evening, way past my bedtime, at 10:30 at night, they showed a documentary about the making of Sgt. Pepper, mm-hmm. because it was 25 years since Sgt. Pepper had come out and Paul was 50. So I kind of realized this, and I asked my mother, who very kindly recorded it on a VHS cassette for
nice.
Me, because obviously I was fast asleep. And then the Monday I went to school, and I was so excited to get home and watch this video. So I get in from school on the Monday, and then I put this in, and it's the documentary that's on the Sgt. Pepper box set DVD that came out a few years ago. So mm-hmm. it was that documentary,
right?
And of course, that in that documentary, they show all the photographs and the footage of Sgt. Pepper. And they've all got these moustaches and these crazy clothes, and they look like... And I was like, hang on a minute. That can't be the same four guys that were running around in the snow in Help.
Right.
It completely blew my mind. And from that point on, discovered, from that point on, it got into my heart, the music, and, you know, as you both know, once it's in there, it doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah. Was there a first song or album that really, like, sunk its teeth into you and, like, made you, you know, that flipped you from, like, the new listener to, like, the hardcore, I've got to find everything I can on this fan?
Well, probably the first one that I can remember loving was I got the cassette of the Red album, you know, the mm-hmm. Red and Blue albums that came out. I got the cassette, and it was probably All My Loving on that I just loved, mm-hmm. Which, of course, little did I know was the song that they first played on Ed Sullivan and that all of America loved as well.
Yeah.
So I always feel a little bit of kind of a solidarity with all those first generation fans that saw that. I just completely loved All My Loving. And then, of course, after that, the next kind of thing that happens is on my 10th birthday, so I still show an interest in the Beatles between being 8 and 9 and stuff. And then my dad got me for my 10th birthday the BBC, Live at the BBC album, mm-hmm. which is quite a strange thing because I didn't have all the albums. And of course, that's all covers and live versions of songs. But that was the kind of the current release.
That was a new one.
That was, you remember, that was a big deal at the time. That was new Beatles music, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the following year, Anthology 95 comes out, and that was when, so I think Anthology is such an important thing for people of a certain kind of age,
yeah,
because it was like, wow, this new Beatles music, and you can watch every week you could watch a documentary about the Beatles that I was, you know, pre-internet, of course. So I couldn't go online and Wikipedia the Beatles at that point.
Right.
I could look them up on Encarta, maybe the online, you know, the CD-ROM encyclopedia.
Yes.
But yes, Anthology was when that was probably when I that was the thing that really kind of cemented my fandom.
Yeah. So I'm curious to know, you know, when do the books enter the picture for you? Because that was something for me once I discovered that like my local library had things not just on books for like things I needed to learn about for school, but on things that I was interested in. It was like, wait, so this library has 8 books about the Beatles, but this other one has 7 more. And this other library has like 5 different books, and my school library has, oh my God, libraries are great. They have all the books on all the things I like. Like that was like a mind blower because I didn't realize, you know, as you just kept finding more and more and you're like, they never stop coming. Oh my God. So like, how do you get into the books thing?
Well, I've always loved, as a kid, I was a big reader. I'm an only child. Mm-hmm. So I used to have a book in every room of the house when I was like a little kid. So I'd have like my kitchen book and my living room book and I'd pick it up and then carry it. That was just what I just loved reading as a kid. Mm-hmm. And my parents, they divorced when I was about 5. So every Saturday I'd go and see my dad. And my dad is still a big Beatles fan. Not to the level that, you know, I got to, but, you know, he was born in 1948. So he was just about the right kind of time for the Beatles. Right. So he said, and he is a big reader. So he took me into just the local bookstore, really, in Brentwood, where I grew up. And as you say, yeah, you got that sense that there would be like a music book section. This is like 1995. So, you know, the music book industry is well on its way. And on that music book section, there would be like a Bowie book and a Dylan book and a book about, you know, the current, you know, I don't know, Madonna or something. But there'd be like 7 or 8 Beatles books. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, that's strange. Why is there so many books? But there's only one book about Dexys Midnight Runners. Or something. You know, there was just like... I couldn't, because obviously when you're a kid, you don't understand, oh, you know, that's a heritage art, you know, what artists mean and stuff. You're like, Beatles are just music, you know, and the music you hear on the radio is just music. So that kind of piqued my interest. And then he got me, we went and I remember on the Saturday, and he got me a very basic kind of like picture book, I suppose you'd say, of the Beatles that kind of told the story, which I've still got. And then he got a copy, which he bought him when he was about 20 in 1968. Of the Hunter Davis authorized biography of the Beatles. Mm-hmm. So I've still got his copy. He still asked for it back from me, but I'm going to keep it.
Is it like an original 1968?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, keep that.
yeah, I've got that. Well, yeah, I'm lucky enough I got to meet Hunter Davis about 10 years ago, so he signed it for me. So I've got a little... I met him at like a talk that he did, and he saw that I was 10 years ago, so I was like 26. Mm-hmm. So he was like, "What? How did you get this?" I was like, "Well, my dad gave it to me." He gave me that book, and that book is the only, as we speak, the only authorized book that's ever come out about the Beatles, and that told the Beatles story in quite a basic way, but essentially the beats of all the books that we've all seen, they all come from that Hunter Davis book. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of, because the way that he told the story, because Hunter was a journalist and was a very talented writer, I kind of fell in love with the story as much as the music. Mm-hmm. And not everyone, I get that not everyone feels that, you know, I'm sure all the people that you've spoken to, you have that great position where the people that you speak to all come at the Beatles from a different way and they all appreciate the Beatles in a different way. But for me, I just loved all these characters that knew them and that worked with them and that were friends when they were at school. And I just loved the story of it. And of course, once, you know, once you realise that even in the 90s there were hundreds of books, I was like, well, I want to find out more.
Yeah.
And I'm still finding out more now.
Nice. That's, you know, I think I'm 100% with you on the idea of the story being such a big part of it, because I think that's what cements it for me, you know, was a big part of it for me, was like, for these guys who, you know, did so much and, you know, were so different all the time, for some reason, you know, and it's, with other bands, this kind of thing doesn't always hold true. But, you know, we had a guest on, Sean Nelson, from the band Harvey Danger, who said, you don't choose your favorite Beatle, your favorite Beatle chooses you. And I think everyone, like, connects to one of them in some way, which is strange because they seem so superhuman, but yet so human at the same time. Like, there's always one that you feel like, that's who I kind of model myself after in some way. And that's such a neat place to be. And to dive further into that story is always so fun and fascinating.
Two things. First of all, that episode was probably my favorite episode of your show. He was just a fantastic, brilliant episode.
Thank you.
We honestly could have talked for like 5 more hours. Right? Like that. Yeah, it was hard to wrap up because we were just like, go on.
My thing about the favorite Beatle is, that's something else that, you know, that people identify with the different Beatle at different points in their life. And this is kind of how I feel that now is when you were a kid. So when I was a kid, I loved Ringo because, you know, all the footage in Anthology, even the interviews that he gives for Anthology, he's just having the best time.
Yeah.
And when you're like 9 and 10, you just want to have the best time, don't you? You just want to run and play and whatever, you know, discover stuff. And then when I was a teenager, John was like the guy.
Yep.
John was like the cool guy. And he was, you know, witty and sharp and, you know, he didn't give a damn. And you know, he lived in New York, and you know, especially for you know, in for me as a kid in England, New York's kind of cool place where, you know, you can get pizza whenever you want. Or I don't know, you know, it just seemed like fun, you know. So then, and then when you're in your 20s, it was George, because George is all about. I think I kind of get the thing with George is that he's all about self. George is, you know, he's very spiritual. But at the same time, he also, you know, was very financially wise and looked after himself and his family at the same time, you know. And when you're in your 20s, you're kind of about, it's about you, isn't it? You're discovering you and you're living your life and you're finding out who you are and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get older, so I'm, 36 now, and suddenly, probably about 5 or 6 years ago, it was just Paul.
Yeah.
It was like, it's always been Paul, because what Paul's about is, you know, family. And you might, as you get older, you might be lucky and you might meet someone and get married and you might have kids and you might, you know, have a great family life and stuff. And that's what he's about, I think, especially in his solo work, you know.
Yeah.
And he just seems like you just relate to Paul as you get older, I think, more, you know, like the line that always reminds me of the line that always gets me that he wrote is in Maybe I'm Amazed, which I think is a fantastic song. Oh, you know, one of the best songs ever. And that line, maybe I'm afraid of the way I love you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like thinking about the relationship that I'm in, how scary is that as a guy, right? How scary is that when you meet someone and you love someone? And you're like, well, that's, you know, and rather
that's not how I'm programmed to be. Like,
yeah,
I'm programmed
exactly.
to be like macho, you know, hardcore guy who doesn't need, you know, no woman.
You've never been that guy.
No. That's not true for me. But
there's sort of a sense that, you know, I think that sums up, you know, as you realize that when you're young and you're like a teenager and you're in your 20s, as a man especially, you know, it's all about macho posturing to a certain extent, especially when we were younger in like the 90s. Yeah. I know now it's a different thing now, I think, because of the way that society's changed. But yeah, that you completely just, Paul just speaks to you, I think, more as you get older.
Yeah.
That's just my take. But, you know, I love them,
you know,
all.
I think that's incredible, though. I think that there's this amazing kind of through line that I think you just kind of nailed of maturity and growth. And I think one of the things that as a teenager, like I was, you know, John was my guy. He was cool. He was confident. He was cocky. He was everything that I wasn't. At least now that I'm older, I know that that's not at all how he was. And it's all a facade. And, you know, now that I'm, you know, my late 30s, I'm 39. I now like you, I relate more to Paul in that like I love you know having a family and being married, and I also can understand like the dynamic of like having to make a band work and trying to like wrangle all these personalities while juggling with your own like, your own thing. So I feel like the more I understand them all, like as I get older, and you can kind of see like why John was as arrogant and cocky and obnoxious as he was in his 20s. It's because he was depressed all the time. Like he had like mental health issues that went largely unchecked and, you know, self-medicated. And then you've got, you know, and so then you get to a point where like the guy checks out kind of mentally and, you know, Paul's like, we got to keep working. Wait, what? Okay, well, I'll pick up some slack. And then he's bossy. And so then you feel bad for him. And now like the story makes so much more sense as you get older. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, I agree with you 110% on that fandom track though. I think that's exactly the route I've taken.
And I think Paul is also really great at, just sort of like expressing human emotions and vulnerability. Like, just like that line you just quoted from Maybe I'm Maze, like it's so vulnerable and it's rare for people to say, to vocalize to millions of people that amount, that level of just like, I love this person so much that it scares me because I've never felt this way before. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but like, shit, what do I do with all of this inside of me? Well, I'm going to put it in a song.
Yeah. And I'll
and make people cry.
And I'll counter that. Maybe I think even the more important line is, you know, maybe I'm a lonely man who's in the middle of something that he doesn't really understand. You know, that involves both, you know, romantic relationship, you know, growth, and all of a sudden he's on his own for the first time since he was 15. And, you know, he's in a whole new world having to restart his life again, doesn't know what to do. Like, that's an open wound on display right there. Like, that's a vulnerable line.
Yeah.
I think.
For sure.
I'd like to take this moment to remind our listeners that at Ranking the Beatles, we do not hate Paul McCartney. We genuinely love Paul McCartney. Every week, another message comes through. Why do you guys hate Paul? We don't hate Paul.
But yeah, it somehow he takes these like very human complex emotions and just it almost seems easy for him to put them out there on display. Like, it's really hard for normal folks like us, but he just is just like, hi, here's me in a song, millions and millions of people. Yeah. Like, I'm putting it all out there. And like, that's so brave. And it's so nice that like, you can refer to it as a touch point. Like, you can say like, I'm feeling this song. That's how I feel. Thank you, Paul, for like putting it out there. Cause it's, you know, hard for people to say their little feelings sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. So,
especially for guys.
Yeah, especially for guys.
Yeah. Well, and me, the Juliatron 5000.
She has no feelings.
He's actually he's the sap of this relationship.
It's totally true. Totally true.
Okay.
I do want to ask also, you know, how many Beatles books do you have at this point? I know your Instagram is a endless feed and I love it. So I'm curious what your grand total is. Do you know?
At some point, I did keep a spreadsheet of the books, but I think I crashed Excel. I think, you know, I think
did you color
Bill Gates
code
was like, what are you doing? You know, I didn't color code.
That's where you go. That's where you go off the rails.
But I stopped. I don't know why, but I stopped doing that. I'm on, I think it's about, so we think, I say we, I think there's been about, since the mid-60s, between 1,000 and 1,500 ever published.
Really?
It's difficult. Yeah.
I think it's way higher than that, but
I think, I think English language, that rules out, obviously there are books that have come out that haven't been translated, but I think it's around about 1,500 that have ever been published. Obviously not all of them are in print now, and loads of them aren't. I'm looking at between 400 to 450 is what I'm on now, which is far too much for a rational human being to ever have on anything.
I love it though,
but it's just, and of course the kind of the thing that's happened in the last year is, since doing the Instagram feed, is publishers, you know, get in touch with me, and so, you know, I've got a a 5,000 following on there now of people that are interested in the books and Beatles. Uh-huh. So therefore, I become a way of, you know, quite understandably, of advertising their book.
Right.
So I very kindly get sent complimentary copies of Beatles books, sometimes two or three. So I'll do a giveaway on Twitter for that. So I get the, you know, I get very kindly, I get these. So that now I don't even have to buy them now.
Living and the dream.
Joe, you're an influencer. That's what that's called.
You're a Beatle influencer.
You're a Beatle influencer.
Put that in your bio on all your socials.
It's true. It's true. What can I say? What can I say?
And so
I mean, as we speak, there are talks ongoing with the British bookstore to get a little kind of association going. So maybe I am... maybe I'm the new a Kardashian or something. I don't know. I'm trying to think of a cool influencer. I can't think of one.
Yes.
You're the Kardashian of Beatles books. I love it.
Yes. That's me. Yes.
I love it. Now, have you read all the books that you have?
I would say I've certainly looked at all of them.
Yeah.
Obviously, a good chunk of them are mainly photo books.
Sure.
So, which I love, I love, Picture of the Beatles. I can never stop looking at Picture of the Beatles for any era, solo or obviously when they were a group. There are some that as you guys both know, that are crazy, that are strange, and that are just bad.
Yeah.
So I'll start to read some of them, and I'm like, this is not. I'm not getting any joy from this. I mean, there's some really crazy ones out there.
Yeah.
But so yes, if I don't get any joy from it, then I won't continue with it. But I've definitely at least looked at and read parts of all of them that I've got on the shelf. Yeah.
What do you find that you're looking for in a Beatles book? Like when you pick up a new one, what are you hoping to get from it?
I'm hoping for someone that really loves the subject. Mm-hmm. I think that's important. I think that's, there's famous examples in the past where people have written Beatles books and they haven't really like the Beatles,
right?
Which I think you've got to be, objective, and you get some books that everything they did was great solo, and that's not interesting really, and that's not, that's not exciting. Mm-hmm. But you've got to have someone that understands what being a Beatle fan is like,
right?
Or someone that understands what being, this is a really good book by former guest on the Beatles Books podcast, Tom Doyle, who wrote a really great book called Man on the Run, which is about Wings and Paul McCartney in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And he's obviously, not all the music that Paul made in the 70s is outstanding, but he clearly loves Paul, understands what made Paul successful. So therefore that book is a really, really great book. You've got to have someone that understands the subject and that has some kind of passion for the subject. Obviously, it's good to know, to find out stuff that you didn't know, which is, there's only so much to know, I suppose.
Right.
But the other thing, what I love is, obviously, you've got the Beatles story, which starts in whenever and ends in whenever. But I love like the little kind of side alleys of a Beatles story. So there's a really cool book which is coming out called Fab Fools, which is by a talented author called Jem Roberts, and it's about the Beatles and comedy, and it looks the association of, you've got a whole load on the Ruttles in there, the kind of their kind of story, what influenced them, what comedians they hung out with, the comedy that they liked. Mm-hmm. So stuff that would only feature a little bit in a biography, but there it's expanded over a whole book. So I love looking at those, Or another cool thing is where you get someone that had an association with the Beatles and you can tell their story. So I've just done an interview actually, and there's with an author that wrote a book about a guy called Robert Fraser, who owned an art gallery in London in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And was famously busted with Mick and Keith. When Mick and Keith got busted for drugs, he was in the house that day, and he got sent to prison with them. But he knew Paul and was friends with Paul, and John launched he did an art exhibition there with Yoko, this Robert Fraser's gallery. So his story is a fascinating story on its own, but because there's a Beatle association with it, I get loads from it. So they're my main kind of pickup points that I look for in a really good Beatles book.
Fantastic.
You have my permission to buy all of those books. They all sound great. Those are great recommendations. Thanks, like, especially like order that Paul McCartney book, like right. Like after we're done filming, please.
Yes.
I want that.
Have you got a lot? Have you got a lot? What kind of level are we looking at?
I've got 30.
Did you count?
I did. I did before that. But what I've realized as I've looked through your feed, I'm missing a ton and I don't know where they are. So I feel like...
Like you had them before and they've just disappeared.
And I feel like I maybe lost them like, or maybe in like a move out of like after college or something, or maybe I gave some, I probably lent some to friends and just never got them back. Mm-hmm. 'Cause the only one that I could think of that I like lent a friend and then was like, I need that book back is the Recording the Beatles book, that like that real thick 400 page one that was like hella expensive. It's like, yo, that's an expensive book, I want that back.
Who did you lend it to?
The Kyle.
Oh. Yeah,
that, but he also he lent me his like mono original Sergeant Pepper, so like,
yeah, no, it's fine. Like you lent it to someone you trust who also loves the Beatles, but you're like, I need that for the podcast. Yeah.
But yeah, I know I'm missing a bunch. I'd guesstimate I probably saw 20 on your feed that I know I had at some point and now I can't find them. So I don't know. I know I also gave a bunch of books to a library a couple years ago when I was just trying to like empty some bookshelves where it was like, I don't need it anymore. But I'm currently at 30.
Okay.
I don't remember the last time I got one. No, the last one I got was, it's called You Never Give Me Your Money, and it's examination on the business dealings of the Beatles. I bought that as a business expense to learn about the pratfalls to avoid in band finances for a previous band. So,
okay.
Yeah. And that band still ended in debt, so it didn't quite work. But yeah, I do enjoy the books. I haven't read one, like a new one in a while, like in terms of like a full biography, just because I felt like I'd gotten to a point where I was reading the same takes over and over again. And I know that like the story's kind of evolving as like new things come out. So I feel like it is time to start diving a little back into that end of it, but I also want to start going more into like the solo end of things. Like that McCartney book sounds truly interesting.
Yes, it does. You should order that, please.
the Plastic Ono Band book that just came out. I really want to look at that. Like that looks really good. And I'm sure the Imagine one is really good too.
I would also recommend, Ken Womack.
I've heard his is great.
He's written a 2-volume biography of George Martin, which is really good. But his book that came out last year about John in 1980, which is an excellent book. And he doesn't go down the kind of true crime aspect of John in 1980.
Right.
So he kind of has this idea where if John didn't see it, it's not in the book. So you don't get any of the drama. No.
Yeah,
and also you don't get any of the, you know, the post December 8th stuff,
right?
Which is, you know, which there are books out there that cover that. If you want to read that, then that's fine. But it's it's really great. There's a great bit in it where David Geffen, that of course is the record label owner, tells Yoko that Double Fantasy at this point has been out for about 2 weeks. It's not doing as well as they were hoping, you know. It was doing well, it wasn't doing as well. So Yoko is in the Dakota, and apparently they're sat in the kind of living room of the Dakota, and Sean's there, and Yoko tells John, it's not doing as well as we were hoping. And apparently John says, it's okay, we still have the family.
Oh.
And I thought, what a great, I mean, she must treasure that.
Right.
And then, you know, in a week he's gone, you know, or whatever. You know, it's what a fantastic thing to find out that she said.
Well, it makes you feel happy for him as somebody who spent his entire life looking for family, you know, and looking for that anchor to his life to like, at least, you know, like when he, you know, when he was taken from us, like he was in a happy place. And that's like, that's a bit of a silver lining, if anything, you know, but that sounds like a good read.
Yeah. The other thing in that book that's great is the last interview that he gave to a DJ called Dave Shaolin, on a New York radio station that's called, I don't. It's always W something. I don't know how it works.
W E V. W E V.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah.
So they're in. He gives this this DJ a lift back to somewhere in New York where this guy lived, obviously. And in the back of the car, he says, "Come on, John, tell us the truth about you and Paul. What you know? What's really the kind of nub of what's going on kind of now?" And John just says, I do anything for him, and I know that he'd do anything for me.
Yeah.
You know, and that's yeah. So, yeah, it's quite an emotional book, but if you're looking for a kind of a recent publication, I would go with the Ken Womack.
Beautiful. I've heard a lot about the Ken Womack books, and I've also heard he's a great podcast interview, too.
Wasn't he on Blotto?
He did do Blotto Beatles,
so. Yeah.
He was my first episode.
Yep.
He was my very first, very kind. I mean, I didn't have any... obviously at that point I didn't have any other interviews. Like now when I approach an author, I can say, well, I've got these 20 episodes.
Yeah.
You know, you guys know that you get a bit more kind of clout if you've got a back catalog.
Yeah.
But Ken was, fantastic. He's written a new book, which is due out in a couple of months, about George Harrison and Eric Clapton in 1970.
Okay.
Which is obviously you've got the personal wife situation going on there.
That whole drama.
But also George was doing All Things Must Pass and Eric Clapton was doing Layla at the same time. So it's about the making of that. So yeah, Ken's wonderful. And if you can get him on, I would 100% recommend you do.
Yes, I need to look into that. Has anyone done like a really good book on Ringo?
Well, there's two major, I say major biographies. There's one that came out in... it came out originally in 92.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Ringo Starr, Straight Man or Joker.
Oh God.
That's what it's called.
Yikes.
Poor dude. That's by an English author called Alan Clayson, who's written quite a few books, and then that got republished about 2005. Then an American author called, believe it or not, Michael Seth Starr.
Ooh.
That's his name, Seth Starr.
Seth Starr.
Ooh. No relation to Ringo Starr. He wrote a book which I think is called With a Little Help, which came out about 2010 or so. And that's interesting. That's good. If you're good, that's probably the best book about Ringo, because that looks at the solo. Mm-hmm. You know, you need if you're going to write a book about a Beatle, I think you need to go into the solo years, because that, like you say, that's the kind of virgin snow that no one's kind of explored that part. I would leave the Alan Clayson book. I would go with Michael Seth Starr if you're looking for a little bit of... Because Ringo's life after Beatles was pretty dramatic.
Yeah,
you know?
He does all kinds of things. Like, how in the world does he get into, like, a TV broadcast version of Alice in Wonderland as the tortoise? Like, it's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my life. And as a child, it terrified me. But, like, how does he end up in that? It makes no sense. I would love to know, like, the in-depth story of how that happens.
Or how he gets involved with the, over here it's called Thomas the Tank Engine.
Yeah.
And is it called Shining Time
Station? Shining Time
Station
was what it was here, yeah. Mr. Conductor. So strange.
Mr. Conductor, yeah. And he's in a made-for-TV, film from in 1986 with Barbara, with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And they play, it's called Princess Daisy.
I've not heard of this.
Right. It's never come out on any kind of home release, but I think it might be on YouTube if you really dig deep enough. And it's those kind of, if I said like Danielle Steele, you know, like it's like that, right?
Uh-huh.
And he and Barbara, it's got Rupert Everett's the lead in it.
Uh-huh.
He and Barbara play bisexual fashion designers. They're not in it that much, but when they're in it, they you can't miss them.
I am here for that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, Princess Daisy. It's got a bit of an all-star cast, but
yeah.
Rupert Everett, I think, is the lead, and they're in it a little bit. But,
it's so interesting. He's done so much stuff that is no longer available, and that's fascinating because everything Paul has ever done is available. And now, like, things that he didn't release at the time, those things are coming out now. Is Ringo going to ever put out the Ogneer Rats TV special? Like
with Carrie Fisher.
Carrie Fisher. Mm-hmm. Like, there's room for that on some kind of reissue. I don't know why he's sitting on that. Who knows?
I don't know. I think some of his albums aren't even on streaming services. If you look on Spotify, there are some of the, I mean, some of them are pretty average.
Sure.
You know, some of the Ringo albums in the like late 70s are pretty average. But you think, you know, you'd want to. I tell you what's really good, actually. I don't know if you know, he did an album in 92 with, do you know the band Jellyfish that came out early 90s band? Yeah, they did. They're a fantastic kind of Beatlesque band. Just did the two albums and they co-wrote some stuff with him. Huh. They did. They had a big hit with over here, I don't know about over there, with The King Is Half Undressed.
Mm-hmm.
Really great song. Their album, the first album, came out the same day that Nevermind came out.
Oh, wow.
And they just had no chance.
Yikes.
But yeah, Ringo's album with them, Weight of the World, I think it's called.
I remember that song. I remember seeing him do that on David Letterman, actually.
Right, yeah. Yeah. There's lots of, so, you know, as we just proved there, you can get a book out of, you know, you can get a really good book about Paul in the 80s or John in LA or George in the film industry. You know, there's so much stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe, have you ever considered writing a book? Because you may have found your book.
If I was going to write a book, I was thinking about this the other day. If I wish I could, I don't think I could ever do, but hey, you know, I never thought I could do a podcast.
Right.
Now, you know. I think I would look at, I've just been reading a really fantastic book about the 90s. Called by an author called Daniel Rachel, who's got a book about the Beatles coming out this year, called Don't Look Back in Anger. And it's a story of kind of Britpop and, it's I'm sure it's out over there. It's like an oral history. So he speaks to, it's not like a prose as such, it's just he speaks to all the major players of the 90s.
Mm.
And I was thinking, I think you could get a good book about how the perception of the Beatles changes through the 90s,
yes,
and the importance of the anthology.
Yep.
I think you know, a lot of the guests that you've had on,
we've touched that a number of times. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've touched on that a number of times.
It's fascinating. The anthology, it was it was a real, I think it really cemented the Beatles in the kind of both America and the US kind of consciousness again. It was a huge deal. I mean, it was a massive thing, wasn't it? It was like,
and it's weird to think now that it's, you know, 26 years old. Like, when I look back at the clips and I'm like, Paul is so young here. Oh, my
young.
God. it's interesting that, like, there's no, I don't know that they could do another, like, version of that in some way because it's so massive. But it seems strange with the way that, like, with just the way that fandoms work now and the way that, like, they're presented as an entity, that there's no, like, updated version of it. Like, I don't think you can buy it online anywhere. I don't know, like, it's not streaming anywhere. Like, it's not on
Hulu.
It's
not streaming, is it?
Netflix.
No, it's not. That's interesting.
Like, if you want to watch it, you have to own it, which I think is a really, like, I mean, that's kind of always been their thing for the longest time. Like, they weren't on iTunes for years, you know. You had to own the record. So maybe one day they'll do it, but, you know, there's still so much to be told in their story. You know,
Didn't the anthology air on TV, like prime time?
Yeah, on ABC, it was over 3 weeks.
Yeah. Okay. I remember that. And I didn't watch it, obviously.
You were too cool for school, I guess.
But I remember it being like a feature thing. Like, I remember commercials for it. And it was like you had to commit to.
It was like 3 hours on three consecutive Sunday nights, I think. And my dad was like, God, please let this end.
It was called, I think over there it was called A Beatles C.
Yeah,
it was on ABC.
It was on ABC Network, and the commercial was like, A Beatles C.
What was Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds really about? Find out Sunday on A Beatles C.
I found the audio from a commercial, like an anthology promo commercial that I used in an episode.
I don't remember that. Yeah. I just remember it existing and just being
big
I don't have the attention span for that. I might have watched like a little bit, but also my parents were not massive Beatles fans.
Yeah.
So I don't know that they would have had the attention span for that either.
Yeah.
I wonder what you were watching instead on November 1995. What was
on?
My
gosh.
Like,
she was probably just high. No.
On a Sunday night, I don't know.
What was the sitcom that was big over there with Helen Hunt? Was
Not
that
about
on the same
you?
Time?
Oh.
Yeah, was it on the same time? I think that was
oh
the rival.
God. You know American TV history,
right? That's amazing.
Wow. I don't know. What would you have done on a Saturday night at 14?
Honestly, I probably would have been doing my homework because I'm a notorious procrastinator. So like anything that had to have been done over the weekend, I probably would have waited until Sunday night to do it. Also, what year was this? 95? We had like the internet at that point. And like I would get on like BBC's, like the bulletin board thing. Like it was like
BBS.
Yeah. That's it. Sorry, not BBC. BBS. Thank you. I'm really tired today. I would get on BBS's and like talk to people. So I could have also been doing. So it was probably either
chatting
like procrastinated homework or just messing around on the internet, doing dumb stuff, maybe playing a game or something.
Yeah.
But no, and we were just watching that instead. So who was having the better time? You know, we'll never know.
We were. Me and Jill were having a good old time. I'll tell
Absolutely.
You that.
Absolutely. I mean, you remember where you were. I do not. So obviously,
I do.
You guys
I remember
win.
The whole thing. I would do my homework early on Sunday those 3 weeks, so I could watch the show at night. Yeah.
So that's definitely important because I know you.
Yeah.
And I feel like you're a worse procrastinator than I am.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
For you to do your homework early, that's pretty monumental.
It was a big deal. It was a big deal. Well, we're here for a reason today. Do you want to talk about our song for this week?
Cool.
Coming in this week at number 174 is Misery.
The world is treating me bad. Misery. I'm the kind of guy.
So in early 1963, as the Beatles were starting to ride high on the success of Love Me Do and the recently released Please Please Me single, manager Brian Epstein is encouraging John and Paul to try their hand at writing songs for other artists. So facing the prospects of an upcoming tour with singer Helen Shapiro, the duo sat down on January 26th of 1963 and began writing the song Misery. The song was originally written with Shapiro's voice and style in mind in hopes that she might be interested in recording the song. So the tour begins on February 2nd, and a couple days into the tour, McCartney presents the song to Helen Shapiro. Now, the song is ultimately rejected by her manager, probably as being a bit more melancholy than they thought was appropriate for their artist. So when the band enter EMI Studios a few days later to record the rest of their debut album, they decide to add Misery to the track listing. Now, the album's always been presented as essentially a snapshot of their live set at the time, but this song seems to actually be an exception to the rule, as the band spend a good amount of time working up the arrangement, and this is all on tape, captured, I think, 8 or 9 takes before they get to a keeper, and coincidentally, all of this is available on YouTube if you want to look it up. It's pretty cool. So the band record 9 takes of the song, with the master being an edit of takes 7 and 9. Now, after the session, a few days later, George Martin adds piano to the track, filling out the introduction of the song, as well as the descending melody in the bridge, which replaced the part that was originally played by George. To do this, while the band were tracking the song at some point, George began recording the band at a faster tape speed, allowing him to later slow down the tape to record the piano at a slower speed, and then speed it back up so it has a higher pitch and different sound. It also allows him to play the parts more in time. So this actually marks the first time that George Martin adds his own instrumentation to the song, to a Beatles song, which he'd go on to do a number of times throughout their career. And it's also maybe the first time they do some actual, like, studio experimentation. Not them, but, like, George Martin on a Beatles product. It's the first time he's, you know, diving into his bag of tricks. So the song is released on the Please Please Me album in the UK in 1963, and on the VJ label introducing the Beatles in the US in 1964. Now, due to a super hard to explain in a short time lawsuit situation between VJ and Capitol Records, the album is pulled from print in 1964, and the flood of releases of early Beatle material from Capitol that year, somehow Misery still falls by the wayside, and with the exception of some singles on a budget label called Starline, Misery is unavailable in the States on any album until May of 1980, when Capitol releases the Rarities compilation. So the band perform it off and on again in their sets and in multiple BBC sessions through September of 1963, at which point it's retired from their live show. Now, a final note, also on the Helen Shapiro tour was singer Kenny Lynch, maybe best known for his song Up on the Roof.
When this old world starts getting me down and people are just too much for me to face, I climb way up to the top of the stairs and all my cares just drift right into space.
He'd offered to do some writing with John and Paul while they were on tour together, and during their writing session, he apparently emerges from the back of the coach bus they were on, saying that he couldn't write with these guys. They didn't know what they were doing. They were actually writing the song that would become From Me to You. However, Kenny ended up shortly thereafter doing his own cover of Misery, which became a minor hit for him. And John was actually apparently a little miffed that he didn't ask him to play guitar on the track, saying that he would have done it had he been asked. That's not always how it works as a songwriter, though. Just because you write it, you don't always get to play on it. And Kenny's Beatle connection doesn't end there, though. He turns up years later on the cover of Band on the Run, and he is the fella directly to the left of Paul. So why do I have Misery at 174? I think there's a lot to enjoy on this song, actually. You know, starting off, the benefit of hindsight with their catalog is always good. There's something to this song that I think sounds somewhat un-Beatle-like. You know, maybe it's because they're, John and Paul especially usually aren't so dour, overtly dour in their lyrics. That's usually George's thing. But I think also it's kind of a restrained song in its performance. So it almost seems like it's maybe a touch more professional, which I think is interesting compared to some of the other stuff on the album, which seems a bit more wild and raw, kind of like what you would hear on at the Cavern. This seems more like a polished studio thing. And I've spoken about this on other episodes. I absolutely love early John and Paul unison vocals, where they're doubling each other and they're so in sync with each other on so many levels that it kind of sounds like a whole third person. Like, it doesn't sound like John double tracking or Paul double tracking. It doesn't sound like the two of them. It just sounds like its own unique voice. And I really love that in early stuff. And when they switch to the harmony on the word Misery, because you've had that singular voice the whole time, the release you get from that harmony, it makes it really stand out. It's absolutely gorgeous. Now, the bridge section is actually one of my favorite bridges that they do. Melodically, I think it's insanely catchy. The descending melody on the vocal then gets answered by the piano. Absolutely gorgeous. And we get the bridge twice in the song, which is a rarity in any song. And now I think it's also kind of a shame that George doesn't really get a place to shine here in the song. But that said, I think George Martin had the absolute right idea with replacing the guitar with the piano track. I think it gives it more maturity and keeps it from sounding like that kind of raw garage cavern feel. I think that's maybe what makes it stand out as a little more polished, maybe. But for a filler song, for an early track, I think it's got a ton of charm, and I really, really enjoy the song, even though I have it placed very low. I enjoy many other songs more than this one. But my two cents, I open the floor. Joe, what do you think?
Well, In general, I like this song, but I think I like it for a different kind of angle than you've said, because one of the things that I get from doing the podcast is speaking to British authors and American authors. You know, that fortunately or unfortunately, that's the main kind of prong attack at the moment of Beatle books. So something that's really interested me is the difference between how British people see and interact and feel about the Beatles to American people. So I think there are certain things that British people understand better about the Beatles, and I think there are certain things that American people understand better about the Beatles. So if I read a book about Ed Sullivan, okay, I'm not going to understand, as try as really as I might, precisely what Ed Sullivan was, as in the Beatles' first show on Ed Sullivan.
Right.
Because, which, you know, is an epochal event in popular culture history of the last 100 years. Okay, I just can't, because it's something that, whereas, you know, for Americans, obviously not everyone watched that show. You know, you guys didn't watch that show because you weren't born. Okay, but maybe even if your parents or a friend that worked at a store that you went to watched it, you've got an inherent understanding of that, mm-hmm. which I don't think I'll ever have. I can't, talking about John in New York, his life there, I can't grasp, I can't understand that as much as, I've never been to New York. Mm. Even if you've been to New York once as a British person, maybe you'll understand it a bit better. And I think with this song, what's interesting is I see it as it's a little bit kind of tongue-in-cheek, okay? Mm. So for me, because like we said, the Beatles are big comedy fans, I think that, the world is treating me bad. Misery. That's the opening line to the song. That I don't think they're being serious. I think that's a, for me, because there were loads of songs, weren't there, in the early 60s of those kind of crooner, like Bobby, all the Bobbies, Bobby V, right. Bobby Rydell. They were all like, I can't believe she's done this to me and all that kind of stuff, which obviously that means it didn't have a big influence on the Beatles. The Beatles listened to rock and roll, American rock and roll and blues. I don't think that a lot of that kind of stuff fed into the Beatles music. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a little bit, it's kind of, although, as a teenager, we can all remember thinking to ourselves, the world's been treating me bad, because you always think when you're a teenager, mm-hmm. the world is treating you bad. Well, oftentimes it really isn't, but that's all part of growing up, and that's fine.
The burden of youth.
Youth is wasted on the young, as they say. So I think it's a little bit, I could be wrong, but I think it's got that that kind of almost like a comedic element to it, where they're kind of, like mugging for the camera. Mm. I don't think they really mean it. But I still think it's still an interesting song. I mean, number one, the thing to remember is it's a song that they wrote, which, that's like on that first album, as you guys know, not many people wrote their own songs.
Right.
So I think it's important that purely for the fact that it's a Lennon McCartney song. Mm-hmm. Talking about Kenny Lynch, have you ever listened to the Kenny Lynch version of this song?
I have. I hadn't listened to it until I started researching for this episode.
Right.
I don't know that I love it. I don't know that I love it.
You've been treating me bad, misery. I'm the kind of guy who never used to cry, but now you're treating me bad. Now I'm sure I won't see you no more. It's gonna be a drag, misery. I remember all the little things we've done. You'll remember and you'll be the lonely one, lonely one.
I genuinely...
You maybe should have let John do the guitar part for that.
That guitar tone is terrible. I didn't realize it was the same guy who sang Up on the Roof. I love that song. But that's also that's a Goffin and King song, and they just are brilliant. But I think there's something about that song that feels... his version of Misery seems so sappy. Like, he's really leaning into, like... I think it's interesting if John and Paul are kind of like, tongue-in-cheek about it, there's no tongue-in-cheek. Like, in the way he changes the lyrics to "You've been treating me bad," it's all so drawn out. It didn't quite do it for me. But I don't know much about him apart from Up on the Roof.
Well, he died about only a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's seen in over here. He's he wasn't well known, that recently, but in the 60s and 70s he was quite a well-known, essentially as a stand-up comedian. He's something that's to remember about him is that he was black, mm-hmm. and in if you looked at British TV in 1963-64, there weren't many, for whatever reason, black performers, mm-hmm. On TV. Certainly not stand-up. I can't think of another stand-up comedian. You know, we didn't have Richard Pryor. You know, right. I mean, we just didn't have that over here at that point. Thankfully, there are many, you know, very talented Black British comedians now. But he, so he kind of stood out for that, and he was quite a, yeah, just a kind of a kind of a homely kind of figure. He wasn't anything. He wasn't lucky. He was kind of a family comedian,
sure,
really.
Sure.
So, and yeah, as you say, he pops up on Band on the Run.
Yeah.
It's quite a strange, I'm not sure what, obviously Paul must have maintained, I mean, some of the people that are on that cover is quite a hodgepodge of people.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Christopher Lee and James Coburn, mm-hmm. And then you've got Michael Parkinson, who, you know, is a very well known in this country chat show host. Mm-hmm. There's Kelly Lynch on there. So, yeah, he's quite an interesting... I mean, he's the first ever cover version, isn't he? I think that's the first ever Lennon McCartney cover.
The first Lennon McCartney cover. Yeah.
So that's something to be said. But, yeah, his version, like you say, is a much more serious... he makes it sound like a crooner, doesn't he? You know, he goes into that kind of Bobby V type, type thing. But I like, as you say, I like the... Like at the end, I think the key thing actually at the end, thinking about what I've just said, is right at the end when they go, la, 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 la. Yeah. That is
the moment where
it's right in the fade out.
It kind of shows that maybe they are tongue in cheek about it, because that is very Bobby, you know, Bobby genre, Bobby style, that la, la, la type thing. Yeah. Yeah. When John does that first O at the end of it, though, like that's like, it's a sweet spot in his voice for me. That's just like, God, that dude could sing. Like, like soul stuff, like he really could do like a great vocal on things like that.
I think it's kind of his, I feel like it's his song more. I imagine that it was his, he brought it into Paul. I'm not sure of the kind of dynamic on there.
The dynamic from what I read is they both like sat down to write it. Okay. They claim it is kind of an equal thing, but maybe, I think they both say like, it's maybe a touch more John than Paul. But they both like were in on it, you know, together at the same time. But maybe John led the session a bit more.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like it's got his kind of fingerprints on it. His fingerprints on it a bit more than Paul. But I like one thing that I love about the whole album is talking about British and American thing. I feel like when I listen to Misery and some of the other songs on Please Please Me, I feel like in 1963. The Beatles were kind of ours a bit, because obviously, you know, they weren't in, you know, they weren't well known in America or other countries, you know. So I love, and going back to what I was saying about those BBC sessions, the majority of those BBC sessions were recorded through 1963 and some into 64 as well. So I've got a huge amount of affection for early, you know, for early Beatles, because it feels like, you know, that they feel a bit more, you know, as soon as they hit America, they become an international thing, and everyone gets their bit of the Beatles. They do a world tour, obviously, do a few world tours. So everyone gets their kind of slice of them. They feel a bit more, you know, this is quite an English, I think it's quite an English sounding song. Mm-hmm. Even though it borrows from that, the American, like we said, the American kind of Bobby thing, it's got a real, it's got quite, I don't know, it feels kind of quite cold and, you know, kind of dour in some respects. I think it's, yeah, it a lot of those early songs, I feel kind of a bit more English. I can't really explain why.
Yeah.
But it just, in my head, they kind of sound a bit more like that. But, yeah, I think it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, most of it. I don't know.
That's fast. I've never considered that perspective on it, but that it makes a lot of sense, though. That it
well,
very
I think
well
that sort of cements the sort of English versus American perspective of the Beatles.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you can identify that in them, because that's, I feel like that's very much like an English trait of, you know, a bit of tongue in cheek, like a. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean it in the best way possible. I absolutely love, like, when you see their humor is amazing. It's biting and funny and sharp and fast and all the my favorite parts of humor. You know, it's not mean. It's sharp.
Yeah.
Which is like the best humor.
Mm-hmm.
I love this take because listening to it, I was just like, okay, yeah, this definitely sounds like a song they wrote for someone else. But putting that tongue-in-cheek spin on it of like, you guys want to write these crooners? We can write these crooners. Watch us. And they write this amazing song that's like beautiful and, you know, has these the descending melodies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, George Martin puts these little spins on it. And they're like, yeah, nailed it.
I think definitely. I think like thinking about humor, you know, how much of an influence do you think was when they landed it in JFK, they give that press conference, don't they? And they're so funny.
They're hilarious.
And they're so witty. They're, mm-hmm. If you watch it now, it stands up.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, and I think, you know, I don't know what, you know, if you watch an interview with Elvis, you know, that I can't, and I'm not a massive Elvis fan. I haven't watched every Elvis interview ever, but, you know, I can't think of, or even like Sinatra, there was a different, an interview situation. A press conference was, you know, it was to promote, it was to sell the latest tour, the latest album.
Mm-hmm.
They're so quick and funny. Then you get the sense that it's completely unrehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think humor was, and if, you know, I think for Americans, speaking as I do for all Americans,
please do, cowboy.
But that must have helped. That must have contributed to you guys just going, wow, these guys are so different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That must have been, you know, that all the interview, all the press conferences in the first tour, you know, by the mid-60s, they get bored and they get tired and they're not as funny.
Well, and then also, like, the journalists are more aggressive and, like, they're trying to, like, get them in, like, a gotcha question, you know, you know, why do you boys not like Jesus Christ? And, like, they're just trying to like find a way to like shove it into them, and you know they're fighting back against it, and they also don't really want to be there anymore. So and then you know it's a you know the one you talk about, you know, after the first couple records they lose a bit of what makes you like feel that British connection. It's almost like once they hit that success and they become globalized, and all these other influences start to become more prominent. So like their country covers of like, you know, Buck Owens things that might have sounded a bit less country 2 years prior when they were doing it like in the Cavern or just like on like a theater tour. It's almost like those kind of, I guess, essential British elements, you know, or edges kind of get rounded off a little bit as these other influences come in. Yeah, I can totally, totally see that.
It would have been fascinating to see what their albums would have sounded like if they'd ever recorded in the States.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was such a, I think they did get, you know, Mark Lewisohn will dig this up for his new book, I'm sure. But I think there is correspondence where they were going to record at like Stax or they were going to record something somewhere.
They talked about doing what became Revolver at Stax in Memphis. And there's a couple of different things about it. Like there's different stories about why it didn't happen. One is that, you know, they couldn't figure out security because once word got out that the Beatles were in Memphis, you know, it was going to be pandemonium. And Stax is a very small building. Like the Abbey Road Studios complex is massive and Stax was a very small building. But then there's also the idea that like Stax wanted a lot of money for them to go record there. And they were like, we're not going to do that. But yeah, the idea of that. And then those two studios make very different sounding records just on their own, in spite of like what guitars you might play, but like the sounds of those rooms are vastly different and produce vastly different results. And the idea, the theory in my head of like, what would Tomorrow Never Knows have sounded like coming out of Memphis?
Mm-hmm.
Like that would have been alternate, like a whole different universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a whole different storyline.
But would it be good or bad?
I don't. Like, who can say?
You know?
Like, there are some things that I think would have been great there. Like, I Got to Get You Into My Life with, like, Memphis horns would have been killer.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of things. But, like, it would have been a very different sounding record. And I don't know that they would have felt as free to experiment also in another studio. Because they wouldn't have had that, like, natural comfort that I think they had in Abbey Road at that point.
Yeah, it's very much a home from home, isn't it? Abbey Road.
Yeah.
You know, that was, or EMI as it was called then.
Right.
Well, I mean, I think the Stones recorded in the 60s in America.
They did do some stuff in, I think, in Chicago.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely. Yeah. So it wasn't like beyond, you know, it was I suppose the equipment would have been, like you say, it would have been a different sounding album.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but then, hey, in a way, I'm kind of glad that they just stayed in leafy London.
Yeah.
and just made almost all the music there. But yeah, I have a huge amount of affection for the 1963 Beatles. I mean, the early I've kind of, as I've got older, actually, I've kind of gone back to the early Beatles more. Mm-hmm. I mean, post 2020 and all the 2020 horribleness. You know, I wanted, you know, you guys know, you just want to feel good.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I yeah. think, you know, songs like, you know, the beginning of Hard Day's Night makes me feel good.
Yeah,
and,
it's just happy.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, happy, you know, that music, even though this song is called Misery, somewhat ironically, you know, the majority of the songs that they wrote on the first four albums, really, they're designed to make people dance
mm-hmm.
generally and feel happy. You know, not a lot of music that's made today is, you don't get the sense that it's designed to make people feel happy. And obviously music is supposed to make us feel all these different things, you know, excited, sad, introspective, angry, whatever. But, you know, my personality is just, I'm quite a fan of being happy.
Yeah.
So I like music that makes me feel happy. And I think the early Beatles, yeah, a lot of this, and this song makes me feel happy. You know, it's called Misery, but it's pretty jaunty.
Yeah.
You know, it skips along.
You can like sing you said, along not... the entire time and, you know,
yeah.
and not have to feel yeah. sad about it. Yeah.
yeah, absolutely. You should never feel sad about singing along to anything.
Yeah.
But you're right. George is not center stage. George is quite, I think, for most of Please Please Me, he's not a huge figure, is he? I don't think he... obviously, but... Even by the second, even though he sings, because obviously he sings on Chains and Do You Want to Know a Secret? But of course, by the second time he's writing his own songs, Don't Bother Me appears. So I think he's the one thing, you know, Ringo keeps the, it's an energy, isn't there, in this song?
Yeah.
And Ringo's great. I mean, how good is Ringo at just keeping that feel, keeping the time perfectly on all Beatles songs? But I listened to the song obviously a few times in the run up to our conversation today, and I got that little kind of halo of happiness from it. And hey, we need that, don't we?
We do.
For sure.
One of the things I keep thinking about, you know, it's really interesting that this song, that they put it as the second song on this record.
Because
that's a pretty like high profile slot on a record. So it's interesting that to me that they're not putting one of the singles there or, you know, arguably like you could say like, oh, what are the other Lennon McCartney songs that are maybe better than that? And I've tried to like look at the track listing and replace it, but I don't know that anything else works there. Like maybe There's a Place might be the only real close option, but I don't know that carries the right energy into it, you know? So it's interesting, you know, I think it's interesting that they took a song that was, and this makes me wonder if it's a Brian Epstein move. It's like, well, let's take this thing that, you know, shows that we can write songs that could be considered for, you know, someone else, and then you're very professional songwriters and stick that up there as well. So it's almost more of like a calling card thing. I found that a very interesting thing in terms of like the track listing, because I know that they're not considering track listing at this point. Like, this is probably George Martin and Brian, you know, putting it together over a phone call or, you know, just talking it out. But yeah, I thought that was an interesting place for it to be.
It's a fascinating thing of like the idea of track listing. When did that become, when did people start to make, you know, now it's like, oh, you've got to put a certain kind of song as the third track. And then you've got to, you know, you had that whole thing of ending side one, you know, you deliberately kind of panned out what the last song on a particular side would be, and then that disappears when you get CDs.
Yeah.
Then it just becomes one long kind of piece. But yeah, I wonder where the idea of, like you say, I imagine that I don't know what decisions they made about, I mean, you know, I saw her standing there. That's built to be a first song on an album.
Yeah, that's the opener for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because you've got the count. You know, the count in is, you know, what a brilliant way to start an album is 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yep.
And you're there. You're there. But yeah, it's interesting. I don't know where. I don't know what influence they had on whether or not this should be the second track or this should be the first track on side two. Or
I'm looking at it right now, it seems very business savvy because side one ends with "Please Please Me," the first number one. Side two starts with "Love Me Do." So it's almost like they're enticing the listener to listen all the way through to the end of the side one. And then, you know, the first song on side two, so flip it over. And, you know, that seems like a very astute business move to like sell an album as opposed to just put, you know, 13 other, you know, filler tracks on there and stick it out and let's make some cash. Like, this seems like a very smart move.
Do you mean to tell me that the Beatles were fairly business savvy and the people surrounding them were fairly business savvy?
Yeah.
Stop. You don't say.
You don't say.
You don't say.
People like money. What can I say?
They do. They do.
Shocking.
So how do we feel, gang? How do we feel at number 174? Out of 223, do you think I'm too high or too low or in the right ballpark? Where would you put it, Joe?
I would put it in absolutely this ballpark or football pitch in my country.
Yes.
We don't have ballparks, that's really. True, I don't. Yeah. There's probably a few. Yeah, I think you're about right. I think it sits in that. Actually, coming back to it in preparation for this, I liked it more than I remembered.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it. But then if I probably would get that with any Beatles song. Yeah. I mean, there's only about five or six that I'm like, no, I can't. I don't get much joy from. And even the ones I don't like, there's something, you know, like even a Paul solo song that's not great, there'll be a little chord change
like that'll catch you and you're like, oh, I like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's me. Yeah, I would say it's in that kind of, I think you've got it in the right bracket. I think it's got a certain charm to it. And for me as a UK listener, it's got that slight, you know, like the Goons, you know, the Goons, Peter Sellers mm-hmm. comedy group. They were a big influence, obviously, on the Beatles, and Ringo did a film with Peter Sellers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
George was a great friend. It's got that slight English, self-pity, joking self-pity, tongue-in-cheek, looking at the camera and winking at the camera type situation.
Right.
And I find that endlessly charming more than, you know, the performance, etc., which I think is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right. Did you enjoy it more listening to it in preparation for this, or how did you feel about it kind of coming back to it?
I found myself, I think, liking it more when I came back to prepare for it. And really listening to the outtakes was really fascinating. I mean, I could do that all day with Beatle outtakes. But it's kind of like, it's rare to get almost every take of a song out there. Like, from the Beatles, you don't have that with too many Beatles songs. It's the same kind of enjoyment you get from listening to like the Strawberry Fields demo all the way through, where you're just watching this thing grow and, you know, hearing them, you know, go through this track, as simple as it is, missing chords here and there, botching lyrics, George trying to kind of figure out the timing on this little riff part, you know, Ringo, you know, adding little fills and then taking them out in the next take, and everybody kind of fine tuning. You know, the Beatles have this great talent of knowing when enough is enough on a song and never overdoing anything. And you can see in early takes as they're trying things and thinking, oh, that's cool. Then they try it again, and then the next take it's gone because maybe it just, you don't need that fill. Just play it straight all the way through, Ringo. Like, that's all the song needs. And you don't miss it. And finding the, you know, hearing them learn how to do that is endlessly fascinating to me. And again, like for me, anytime the two of them are like doing a unison vocal, I'm there. Like, it's such a cool vocal sound to me that I think is like the hallmark of early Beatle things that I love. So, you know, that's, you know, I think I enjoyed it a lot more than I remembered I did. What do you think? Where would you put it, my dear?
I think it sits pretty well. I actually enjoy it a little bit more with Joe's take on it, so thank you for that. thinking of it as like a tongue-in-cheek as opposed to a very serious composition by very serious people. Because I was wondering, I'm like, they're pretty young at this point. Like, this is a pretty intense song for such young people to write. And then you said that it was written for someone else who is probably a little bit older
for a
than
woman.
Them. Yeah.
See, that's my other question is what's the first line of the song for Helen Shapiro? Because in here it's, I'm the type of guy who never used to cry. So what's that lyric from her perspective when they present it to her? I have to wonder if was there a different lyric on it originally that maybe nobody knows?
I don't know.
Maybe.
How old was she?
Well, she was, that the thing about her that's interesting is she was a big star in the UK in 1962, and her gimmick or if you whatever was she was 14 when she first became famous. She was like a child star, like a kind of I don't know, like a Shirley Temple. She wasn't an actress, but her kind of shtick, if you can call it that, was that she happened to be young. And they did there was like she was shown on TV recording, like it was like a kind of documentary about her recording some of the songs. She was a big star in about 1961. She had a big hit called Walking Back to Happiness.
I have loved you more each day, walking back to happiness. Whoop-ah, oh yeah, said goodbye to loneliness. Whoop-ah, oh yeah.
Whoop-yah, oh yeah, is the next line. which is a good, fun song. And then, unfortunately, she... her kind of pop career did fade away post Beatles, like a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But she's obviously, because she was young when she was famous, she's still with us now. She's done some really, she's interviewed a lot about the Beatles because she did that first tour.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Big crush on John, who apparently was obviously a bit older and was incredibly gentlemanly and was very kind and understanding
to her.
Thank God. Thank goodness for that.
Yikes.
It's interesting because, she would have been, so when she was on tour with them, she was like 16.
Yeah.
Wow. So they wrote this for a 16-year-old? That's shocking. I assumed that she was like bare minimum, like mid to late 20s or something. It seems like such a mature song.
As far as I know, I don't think she ever had any real impact in the States commercially. My entire knowledge of Helen Shapiro is that she was the headliner on that first tour. Like, I know not much else about her. I don't know that anything ever crossed over here for her.
No, I mean, it was quite an English, quite a tinny sound. It had that kind of a pre-Beatle, early 60s sound. You know, like people like Cliff Richard, you know, a lot of those English acts, Adam Faith, they just didn't translate over to you guys. That I, you know, it's, you know, because you had like, you know, you had a lot more going on. You know, you had all the rock and roll stuff. And then you had like, you know, some of those early Phil Spector stuff. You know, if you look at the stuff, it was, you know, you just had much more lush sounding
and
records.
Like in 62, you know, she's having hits in 61, 62. That's when we get like, the Beach Boys are the biggest band in the country at that point. Like early Beach Boys, like Jan and Dean, surf rock stuff becomes like, you know, the flavor of the moment. Because Elvis had been in the army at that point and kind of, you know, the early rock and roll guys kind of, you know, various legal things brought them out of the spotlight for a bit. And then, you know, the Beach Boys took over for a bit and then the Beatles hit. And you know, then, you know, all bets are off at that point. But yeah, it's a very different time in American music there, for sure.
Interesting.
There is a clip of her on, which is worth seeking out, which you might have already seen, actually. Ready, Steady, Go, I think, which was the big pop kind of TV show we had in the early to mid 60s. She's doing a song called Look Who It Is, which sounds, she's one of those artists that like had a hit and then all the other songs would sort of sound like that song.
Yeah.
Which you get now, you know, that's not a new thing.
Sure.
And so she's doing, and the Beatles were on the same show. They had their kind of the no collar suits on, and she's doing Look Who It Is, and she's singing it to the, and there's, I think it's Ringo, George and John, and she's kind of like singing it to them and like putting her arm on their shoulder and stuff. So there's a little bit of film, which is, it's on YouTube. Unfortunately, she's not, her singing career kind of went a little bit by by the wayside. But she's still with us, and she did a good documentary about her kind of time with the Beatles about 10, 15 years ago. So,
nice.
But yeah, her singing this song, as you just said then, it's quite a stretch to imagine her singing it, because it is, for her kind of angelic 16-year-old kind of, you know like how women dressed in the early 60s. She was, very kind of dressed in quite a conservative manner, mm-hmm. and, very, very neat hair and stuff, and the world is treating me bad might not have fit with that look. But
right. Yeah.
We'll never know. We'll never know.
No.
Yeah. You almost wish that she would, do a cover of it now.
That would be funny.
Let's do it, man. Why not?
Maybe she has. I'm sort of amazed. People have dined out on the Beatles enough, as we all know.
Right?
That I would have thought she might have thought about at least singing it live or something.
Yeah.
She used to tour. You know, she would still have, an audience.
Mm-hmm.
She did have those few hits. I'm amazed that she's never.
Yeah.
Would
she be at at the International Beatles Festival as a speaker or performer? Is she the kind of person they would have? Because that'd be fascinating. Mm. All right, Helen, let's do it now. Come on.
Yeah.
Pick the key. We got you.
No, I think she's not. She doesn't tend to do those things. I can't. The times that I've been and been aware of, she hasn't been. Because I think she tries to, a lot, some people quite understandably try and keep their own career
separate.
Separate rather than just being a Beatle person, someone like Bill, Bill Harry that wrote, that started the Merseybeat newspaper. He's a professional Beatles person, and that's fine, and that keeps a roof over his head and whatever. But yes, she's someone that's got enough, just in the UK, certainly enough of a kind of a career to not have to do that. But she's spoken about the Beatles at length about that tour. That's because, of course, the embarrassing thing for her was people weren't really there to see her.
Yeah, by the end of the tour, they're the big headliner. Yeah, even though they're not the headliner.
Yeah.
Did they end up switching on that tour? Am I correct on that?
It might. Yeah, because they did the other tour.
Yeah.
The other tour they did was with Chris Montez and Tommy Rowe. Yeah, Chris, who did Let's Dance. That was his big hit,
mm-hmm.
Which is a kind of fun early 60s song. I think that might be the tour where they'll switch. I'm sure the internet will tell us in your emails.
Yes, it will be in the comments.
Yes,
I think that's also the tour where I think Tommy Rowe beat the crap out of John at some point.
Right,
because John got drunk and talked some shit and dumped a beer on his head, and the dude just clocked him in the face.
Yikes.
Misery. Oh, okay.
yeah.
Well, Joe, do you have some time for some rapid fire questions before we let you go?
Absolutely. Far away.
Wonderful. All right. Rapid fire number one, your favorite Beatles song, and it can be just today or all time.
Today, We Can Work It Out.
Love it. Least favorite.
Probably Hold Me Tight.
Ooh, okay.
With the Beatles.
Yeah,
don't, just not there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Fair enough. Favorite album?
Hard Day's Night.
Least favorite album?
Controversial. Okay. Mm. Controversial take. It might be, and I can feel the weight on my shoulders. Do you know what? Least favorite album? It might be Let It Be.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be Let It Be. Yeah, I think it's, there's not as much, the love and the energy are kind of starting to fade away when they're making that. And the thing I love about the Beatles is the hope and the positivity and the energy. And I think some of those songs, it's not there entirely. So probably Let It Be.
Gotcha. And your favorite memory associated with the Beatles, or a Beatles song, or a Beatle?
Well, I will need a second to think about that. Hang on.
I love this one.
Yeah, my favorite memory. Probably. Do you know what? Probably, as I said, I used to go and see my dad every Saturday, and he had all the Beatles albums that he bought on vinyl. And in 1993, 1994, vinyl was, as you remember, kind of less of a thing. It was, mm-hmm. hey, who wants records? No one wants records.
Who wants to carry those things around?
Exactly. I'd rather have a mini disc or something. I don't know.
A disc man.
Yeah. And I would just go, and 10, 11-year-old me, Saturday afternoon, in my dad's house that he still lives in now. It's very nice, quiet English suburby house that he lives in. We would take out the albums and we would talk, and he would tell me, well, that song is about that, and that song goes like that, and this is from when they were kind of crazy and took loads of drugs. And he kind of gave me the grounding in the Beatles. So just those cold Saturday afternoons learning about the Beatles. That's probably my favorite memory.
That's fantastic. Oh, that's so sweet. I love that. That's wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Joe, tell all of our listeners, where can they hear the Beatles Books podcast? Where can they follow you on the socials?
So we have two socials. We have the aforementioned Instagram page, which is at Books Beatles, where every day I'm archiving and then discussing my collection of Beatles books. Also on Twitter, again, at Books Beatles, where I talk about the podcast and other kind of tweety type things. And the Beatles Books podcast is on all the usual podcast platforms. Yep. Where each it's released. I aim to release every 2 weeks. Sometimes I get a bit clogged up and have to release some more, as you guys probably sympathize with that.
Oh yeah.
I speak to Beatle authors about either forthcoming or existing books, or other writers and podcasters about their favorite Beatles books.
And how did the podcast come about for you? Because I think you started this in September, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're not far behind us. Did we start in July or August?
July.
So I think we're part of what Sam Wiles from Paul or Nothing calls like the third wave of, of Beatle podcasters.
It's nice to be in a wave, quite right? frankly.
I'll take it.
So do you know what? It kind of came out of, as I was saying, like the publishers would send me the books. A couple of them, separate kind of emails came in, and they were like, well, I get it completely. They're thinking about commercial aspect. They want to sell books. Mm-hmm. They were like, two of them said, maybe there's a podcast kind of idea in this, because clearly you've got a lot of knowledge and you've got a big collection of Beatles books. You thought about doing a podcast. And the first time I read it, I was like, no, I don't think so. And then randomly another publisher emailed me to say, this is a new book by whoever. Have you thought about doing a podcast? Maybe you should do a podcast. And then I was a guest on the wonderful Two Legs podcast, mm-hmm. Which I'm sure you guys are aware of, that do a lot of great stuff about Paul. And I really enjoyed doing that. And yeah, it started in September with Ken Womack. And then I had Ken McNabb, my second guest. I was like, am I just going to interview Ken? Is it going to be Ken? You know, I can't think of anyone else famous called Ken. But yeah, and it went on from there. So, it's such a joy to do. I love it. Speaking to people from all over the world.
Yeah.
It's just a fantastic, it's a real labor of love.
For sure.
And it's great that people like it. It's lovely to get, as you guys know, I'm sure, it's great to get really good feedback.
Yeah, it's great to get feedback. You know, it's fun, you know, growing up, and you probably came from the same situation, you know, growing up in the 90s, where the internet wasn't what it was today. Like, I didn't do the bulletin board sites things as a kid. So I really had no one to, like, share my fandom with of the Beatles. Like, I remember going into class one day and talking to it about kids at the table next to me, and they looked at me like I was an alien. Like, they could not have cared less. So, you know, it took me a long time to, you know, find my tribe of people who are into this same thing. And one of the things I've loved about doing this for the last, you know, 6-8 months, whatever it's been, is like meeting all these people that are fans and that host podcasts like this, or listen to podcasts like this, and like becoming friends with them and getting to talk and getting to know them. Like, it's been such a joy to do it. And, you know, I absolutely, you know, we have a ball doing this. It's so much
and
fun.
And learning new perspectives.
Learning
and
new perspectives on something that I've listened to a million times. Yeah. Like, it's so much fun.
It's like fresh for you
it's
again.
Freshening. It's refreshing my love of this music, for sure. Well, Joe Wisby, thank you so much, man. We really, really appreciate you coming on the show. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much. And everybody, please check out the Beatles Books podcast and Books Beatles on Instagram and Twitter. Wonderful.
And go buy some books.
Thanks, guys.
And go buy some books.
Yeah.
We're going
to
do that.
Joe Wisby, everybody. What a blast. How was that?
That was amazing. He
so
totally
much fun.
Blew my mind with his take on the song.
Yeah.
And I am very happy.
Likewise. I had not considered that perspective that it's tongue-in-cheek. I love it. Totally game changer.
Like it better.
I also will have to thank him personally for pretty much you giving me the green light to buy all the Beatles books that I want now.
Whoa. I didn't
shout
say
out
all.
Joe. Thanks,
nope,
bro.
Nope. Did not say all. I said those that he mentioned sound very good.
I'm just
going to
start hitting the Amazon wish list and just clickety, clickety, clickety. One click, one click, one click, one click.
Listen, I get the email notifications. I will know. I will go in and cancel.
Yeah, you will. So, friends, what do you all think about Misery at 174? Too high, too low, or just like Baby Bear's porridge, just right? Let us know on the comments on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those good places. You can follow us on Facebook at
Ranking the Beatles.
You can follow us on Instagram at
Ranking the Beatles.
You can follow us on Twitter at
Ranking Beatles.
That's right.
Nailed it.
Nailed it. let us know what you think. We love, love, love getting your feedback. We love your comments. We love your reviews. We've gotten some really, really nice reviews lately that have meant a whole lot to us. So thank you for that. And we've gotten some really nice DMs on Instagram lately. Had some really interesting conversations with people from all over the place. Talked yesterday with a listener from Israel.
Amazing.
Yeah, love it. Wonderful. Fantastic. So thank you all so much for enjoying our show. We hope you're digging it. We're having a lot of fun with it. Go listen to Joe's wonderful podcast, the Beatles Books podcast. He's got no shortage of episodes to do because, you know, 1,500 books.
Yikes.
Get on it. and his Instagram feed is fantastic as well. So many cool things to see on there. Mm-hmm. So that's it for today, y'all. So until next week, have a wonderful week. And we'll holler at you next Tuesday or whatever day you listen to us, with a brand new episode. So, till then, I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Julia.
This is Ranking the Beatles. Adios.
Bye, y'all.